the time and the place it's been set for the special rules hearing for the May term, where we will consider three proposed rule changes. Rule number one, with proposed an amendment to Canon 3B7B of the Code of Judicial Conduct. Is there anybody that wishes to speak on behalf of this rule? Very well. There being none, we'll proceed to proposed rule number two. This would propose an amendment to Rule 8.4 of the Rules of Professional Conduct. Is there anybody that wishes to speak to this rule?
Mr. Chief Justice, Justices of the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court of Tom Barnett, representing the State Bar. The proposal which is before the court today simply clarifies under 8.4 that it is professional misconduct for a lawyer to knowingly offer defamatory evidence. I refer the court to Rule 3.3 sub 4, which currently says almost precisely the same thing, specifically a lawyer shall not knowingly offer evidence that the lawyer knows to be false. I believe that the court knows the history or genesis behind this proposal. We worked it out during the session in light of, I believe, the Senate Bill 250, which would have amended the privilege statute under 20-11-5. We think that an amendment to that privilege statute would have had a serious chilling effect on the lawyer's ability to represent the client. On the other hand, the governor raised an excellent point that perhaps our members were unaware of the provisions of 3.3 sub 4, and perhaps that 3.3 sub 4 was not quite broad enough. So we bring you this amendment. I can tell you that the disciplinary board was unanimously in favor of this. I can tell you that the bar commissioners were unanimously in favor of this proposal. For those of you who have been following the Ethics 2000 at the ABA level, chaired by Chief Justice Vesey from Delaware. The import of the Ethics 2000 revision to the Rules of Professional Conduct is to better explain and clarify and send a message to the lawyers, putting them on notice what is acceptable conduct and what is not. And in that vein, we think that this amendment to 8.4 does precisely that. There are several instances, or we can think of anecdotally, that 3.34 may not cover. In the old days, when we all practiced law, it was routine to file all depositions, all interrogatories, and so forth. And arguably, 3.34, at least by the catchphrase, at the top, talks in terms or raises the connotations of, I'm before a judge in court, and I knowingly make or offer false evidence. The amendment 8.4, of course, that the court is considering today, makes it clear that if you're acting in your capacity as a lawyer, that you may not knowingly offer defamatory evidence. I'm aware several members of the bar have expressed concern about the definition of defamation. Defamation is defined in the code under Chapter 20-11, and that by South Dakota law says it has to be false evidence. And so we think that's consistent. I'm aware that some were concerned that, in fact, this amendment that we proposed may have the effect of changing the privilege portion under 20-11-5 sub 2. I submit to the court that they're misreading it. The privilege statute, as it exists today, provides immunity for a lawyer in a court proceeding to perform their job and be an advocate. And the law, it goes perhaps just one little extra step further by noticing all the members of the bar that they have to comport to that honesty standard in all aspects of representing their client. That if they violate that, they cannot be sued under the defamation statutes unless you can show malice and so forth in the first order of the exceptions. But they are subject to professional discipline, which ultimately brings them before this court. And so we don't think this has any impact whatsoever on the privilege provisions of 20-11-5, yet it does put our members on notice that they may not offer knowingly defamatory evidence. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Well, you know, I kind of question your language here. You say to knowingly offer evidence. Knowingly, is, to me, applies to and modifies the offer. In other words, to intentionally offer. And I think if you're to do what you're trying to do, I think that you should say to offer defamatory evidence, knowing that evidence to be or to constitute defamation under South Dakota law. I mean, the knowing part of it should modify the defamatory evidence rather than the offer.
I have no quarrel with that analysis. I understand exactly where you're going, where you're coming from, and I know that when we reverse the order, your point's well taken, and then offer evidence that the lawyer knows to be false. So in our wordsmithing, I think your suggestion, Justice Sabers, probably is meritorious.
It might be defamatory in the eyes of some of it. It might be accurate to get to the truth, really. Right?
And I think that that's the first status of the law also, Justice.
Any further questions, comments for the representative of the state bar?
You said it was, how come it was in Senate Bill 250? Where'd that come from?
It was the governor's bill, and it was designed to remove the privilege that has involved lawyers, and I might add it also involved lobbyists and others who would routinely appear before legislative committees or appear in court. The lobbyists never caught up to that during session, but from the standpoint that it would have a very chilling effect on the lawyer's ability to do their job, we caught it right away. And when we ascertained what the governor's concern was, we determined that there was some merit to it. And that's the genesis.
Thank you, Mr. Barnett. Is there any further comments on the proposed amendments to Rule 8.4? Mr. Weber.
Justices, excuse me. My name is Brent Gilder. I'm an attorney from here in Superior. I'm legislative counsel to the office of the governor, and I can cover a little bit with you the legislative history of Senate Bill 250. The governor has become concerned in the last several years with what he sees not only as a lack of civility in the practice of the law in South Dakota, but an actual use of court proceedings and legislative proceedings and other matters as a political tool, sometimes utilizing false testimony or false evidence. He asked me to author Senate Bill 250. He asked me about 3 hours before the deadline for the introduction of governor's bills. So we put Senate Bill 250 together and introduced it. There were some concerns raised during the legislative session, and it has come to you as the amendment to Rule 8.4 is as a result of that. We will be in support of that as it now is, and as I said, we talked to the disciplinary board about it. They seem to be unanimously in favor of it. And the governor would strongly support it. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
This wouldn't do anything as far as for the legislative process?
No, it would not. Senate Bill 250, as I recall, was originally drafted, would have encompassed the legislative process.
Do you have any thoughts on the change proposed or discussed by Justice Sabers that would have to knowingly refer to defamatory evidence rather than to knowingly offer?
I would have no objection to all that, Your
Honor. Any further comments or questions for Mr. Wilber?
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Any further questions or questions? Any further comments? that, we'll move along to the third proposed rule, which is the adoption of implementing standard guidelines to be used statewide for child visitation in divorce or separate proceeding actions or any other custody actions. And this is mandated by the legislature's passage of House Bill 1302 during the completed past legislative session. Anybody wish to speak on this? Representative Koester.
I am Representative Parents Koester, District 9, Garrison, and I appreciate the opportunity to do the third and I will do today. I'd like to preface my remarks by giving some comment that the history of 1302, which we're dealing with today, I was not pleased with the beginning, and you have the proposal that I did introduce. This bill was introduced by the government, primarily because of the veto of the House Bill 1144, the prior year that dealt with child and custody. And this bill passed the Senate and the House and vetoed by the governor. And he felt all year that there was still some major concerns. So he introduced the bill 1302 regarding custody and child shared parents. I also introduced a bill last session, and I asked that it be tabled, and I wanted to cooperate with the governor because I thought through the committee, which he asked for, that we could probably resolve some of these differences. But if I may address to the court and state, what you're looking at 1302 is completely different what you have before that started. When the governor introduced this legislation, he called for a committee, and that committee would make recommendations to the legislature. Again, to the legislature, to change existing laws and create new laws that would improve the well-being of children during divorce proceedings. And my question that I had, I tried to get involved with this. However, I asked to be appointed also to that committee, and I wanted to participate in that committee. However, the first two meetings was not invited, or there were other people who was held at the governor's mansion. The second one was the telephone conference. And from that meeting, the state of Georgia just going to go with the guidelines. And in several instances on the House and through the Senate, we tried two amendments. There was some objection from the governor's office on this, and you will probably hear some testimony today. People objected to that. They felt that it was somewhat unfair because when they got here, they could not testify for various reasons. And I understand. One of them was when the testimony, because you had hearings, you had to meet the judge that introduced it prior to one. But there were many people that were upset. And so when I say I'm representing a number of people that are concerned with this. The proposal that I have myself, I've been working with child custody and such for a number of years. Part of this came from the TANF program, where they picked up they got the enforcement of child support. And this involved many families. That also was involved with some grandparents and such that no longer had visitation to their grandchildren. And the end result was that we did have custodial parents, oftentimes the mother, they would leave the state. And what we're asking for in this proposal that they would be limited, they close that loophole. And I used the term in there, the 60 miles. The idea, in fairness, to an hour's drive, even at the custodial parent and a non-custodial parent, in most cases, the father, he had access to that child. Rather than moving out of state and distance. Right now, there seems to be a loophole. This would close that loophole by less, through a shared parent or through an agreement that these parents, not the custodian, not the custodian, could agree that they could take that child out of state or move a distance of career. Or if the courts would get involved with this. They're always concerned, and it's in the best interest of the child. And I believe the point, if I may, some of this is addressed in your guidelines. So what we would ask, if you look at this type of thing, there's some way part of this, if not all of this, could get inserted in there, or at least be addressed. And I think you'll hear other testimony and concerns similar to this, but this is just one small component that I and many other people would like to see addressed by the court. And I understand there are questions.
Yes, sir.
I have a follow-up. If this is an issue
that's been debated in the legislature, and yet for some reason can't get passed in the legislature. Keep in mind the separation of powers that you're off of my word. Why should we, or should we, as a court, legislate something that the legislature is not able to agree on themselves? It seems to me like you're almost asking us to be a super legislature.
If I may, Your Honor, this custody bill that I'm talking about basically was passed by the House and Senate, and it was another branch of government, exactly that could be with him.
But the process of the three branches of government, you've been unable to get it through. And I'm just looking at the provision in your letter now. This section on custodial parents that move. Should that go to the legislature?
Your Honor, I would think so also. In fact, that would probably be the next route to go. That we could, because when we say is this route, well, we've already done that. But now we have the new governor, etc., I would bring it back again.
Okay. Any other questions for Attorney Christian? If not, thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Any further comments on the proposed guidelines? Yes, ma'am. What's your name, ma'am?
Deborah Watson.
All right. And you have submitted a statement and that has been furnished to Captain's report. Can I proceed?
Can I proceed?
Yes.
Mr. Chief Justice, fellow justices, I'm going to please report to the afternoon. My name is Deborah Watson. I'm with the law firm of Watson, Baltimore, Maryland, and Rapid City. And I've submitted to you for your consideration some South Dakota co-parenting guidelines together with a computer-generated comparison of differences between those that were with your packet and those that I submitted. As a person who does practice family law extensively, the guidelines have been an incredible tool, and thanks to Justice Coney Kent and to his team of experts in drafting them, they've been a wonderful tool. They took a lot of the conflict out of separation and divorce and giving up the parents and the children a little bit more certainty as to what's going to happen as they go through this turmoil. And it's nice for the lawyers, and I know also for the circuit court judges, to be able to tell our clients that unless they agree otherwise, or the court orders otherwise, or there are special circumstances, these are the rules of conduct that parents have to follow, and a typical parenting plan that's going to occur. One of the fundamental changes that I'm asking you to consider in these standard guidelines is changing the terminology, moving away from the word visit and visitation for the non-custodial parent. Following the separation of the divorce is critical for the non-custodial parent to continue to care for their children, and he or she should not be deemed a visitor. How would you like it if you went to your lawyer's office and your lawyer said, these are the visits that you can have with your own children? It's terribly disenfranchising to the non-custodial parent.
Can I ask you this?
What's your name?
When a court orders visitation, it doesn't disenfranchise a parent, does it? You're always a parent, aren't you?
You are. But the term itself, Your Honor, I'm saying is disenfranchising. What I try to do when I work with clients is tell them that we want to set up a parenting plan that's going to be in the best interest of their children, and that also works with them in terms of their personal and their work schedule and, of course, the children's activities. You know, having time with their children is critical. It's just, I just don't think it should be called a visit.
Are we not bound by the language the legislature uses in this particular statute? And this is a situation where the legislature enacted this statute and then said the court is to make the guidelines that apply to our statute. And this statute uses the word visitation. Also, we have other statutes that use the word. How can we change that without violating the tenor of the statutes?
Well, basically, the statute does indicate visitation, but it also indicates that the Supreme Court is to promulgate standard guidelines. That's what they're asking you to do. So I think by promulgating standard guidelines, you can get around that. I guess people can still call it visits. But really, what we're working out is a parenting plan for the children after their parents' separation or divorce. So,
but nothing keeps you from doing that, does it? I mean, you can still present a parenting plan to the court, and the court approves that that's the rule between the parents.
That's true, but we still call it visitor visitation. And that's what's disenfranchising.
I personally agree with you. As you may know, the latest version of these guidelines changes that term to what you suggest. But the problem is now we are dealing with legislative terminology. Isn't there a concern that if we use shared parenting in the guidelines, but all the statutes talk about visitation, and that create an ambiguity, a confusion about what is, in fact, the guidelines?
I don't believe so, but of course, you know, we could go back to the legislature next year and clean up the statutes, if that's what the Supreme Court decided to adopt as their standard guidelines. And I think we all know what we're talking about tonight. I mean, I think that the kind of lawyers who practice this will understand that's what's occurring. I did submit, and were there any other questions on that? That was one of the fundamental changes that I was recommending. I did submit to you the changes, and I just kind of want to walk through with you some of those that I think should be added to what the court has. I'm starting with page one. And these changes basically are as a result of our experience working with treasurers with these families or questions that our clients have. The first change would be the introductory, these are promulgated as unofficial guidelines. Actually, once this court adopts them, that sentence will no longer be necessary. And then in that first paragraph, again, towards the end, it looks like about the second to the last line, where it talks about unless these guidelines are incorporated into a court order. Of course, once the court promulgates these, then the language changes. So I would suggest that we just pick out the statutory language indicating upon the filing of a summons and complaint for divorce or separate maintenance or any other custody action or proceeding, these guidelines shall become an order of the court upon fulfillment of the requirements of service and shall apply in continuing effect unless the parties agree that the court orders otherwise.
I'm not following. Where are you? Are you looking from the document with the pink?
No, I was just indicating that that was another change that we'll need to make once he's at a final meeting that I can give these to them.
In addition to what you've already said?
Yes.
Could I ask another favor of you? Assuming that we might take some of your suggestions, do you have these already on a disk so that perhaps we don't have to retype them?
I do.
Do you have it here, or?
Could
you drop it into my office in the Rapid City? I would appreciate that. Okay, thank you.
The first major change is in the bottom of the first paragraph. Actually, this is not just me. I've consulted with a number of other family law lawyers and assisting in making these changes, as well as some other around child development experts in our area and throughout the state. One of the things that we're recommending that you include in your standard guidelines is that there be an annual calendar prepared and shared so that the children and the parents all know the parenting plan. What I recommend to my clients is that they do this and they post it on the refrigerator or some obvious place in their home. This seems to minimize the conflict between the parents about the schedule, and it also gives the children an opportunity to know when they're going to see a non-custodial parent. So they're not wondering what is going to happen, and they know what's going to occur, and can prepare their time, and their suitcase, and you know, their emotional well-being to get prepared for that visit, because there are changes in households. So I found that that's a useful tool that some of us travel interviews on.
It's kind of picky, but should that be an annual calendar or calendar? Annual calendars. It's plural, not singular, because if there's not one on the other refrigerator, it's not going to do a lot of good in some cases.
Right, and typically, the reason I said that quote that way is that typically one parent prepares it and it's shared. Typically, we try to get the parents to prepare it together. If that's not possible, then one parent prepares the children to the other parent. They make any changes based on their vacations and that sort of thing. So typically, there's only one calendar prepared, but I guess that's what we're thinking. There would be a calendar every year, and we're hoping that it's something that the parents can agree on, at least if they can, they can do it through the council or the mediator or whoever's assisting them in that regard. The next change would be in the second paragraph, still on the first page of your general rules. I'm suggesting that you delete the sentence that talks about grandparent visitation. It's my position that I suggest to you that it's not necessary. It's really a separate issue. And I do know that there are several constitutional challenges out there to the grandparent statute. based on the U.S. Supreme Court case of Trussell and Granville. So I guess I think maybe
one of the forms of modification of it just simply provided that the South Dakota statute such and such provides for visitations with grandparents and said nothing more than that.
Okay.
Whether, you know, and that would obviously be harmless.
That would be harmless. And the grandparent visitation usually doesn't become an issue unless there's a problem with the parent that doesn't want the grandparent or the parents not wanting the grandparent visitation. Usually the children visit the grandparents when they're with the parent. So that's, you know, really, and we're looking at the grandparent visitation statute. So.
With these guidelines, only a lot of people in category. I mean, it's.
That's right.
Yeah, and the other thing, of course, is they're all subject to fine-tuning and modification as we get down the road. This is kind of our maiden voyage into this area as far as they've been around for years as suggestions in some circuits, and I don't know what their legal status has been, but they've been around a long time, and before we realize it, we'll all be probably making some review of them.
And that's basically what some of the new lawyers and I have really done is some of the things that we found that would be more helpful we just added in. On page 2, under grade reports and medical information, I've added in that the non-custodial parent shall also be listed as a child's parent and as an emergency contact with the daycare school and with all medical professionals. What we're experiencing is that they put down their boyfriend or a friend or a work associate or their grandparents and can't be with the other parent. So the other parent then was never notified in the event of issues regarding their children. So I just thought this might minimize some of those issues. It also, earlier in there, the non-custodial, or the custodial parent is required to also provide notices from the school and authorize those individuals to provide information to non-custodial parents so that we don't have to go to court to get an order to get this done, because then the non-custodial parent has to go to the lawyer, and then the lawyer has to go to the judge to get authorization for the non-custodial parent to get school reports or find out information at the doctor, and this information they really that they should have.
How would this interrelate with what often occurs with protection orders where one parent is barred from having contact with the children?
Well, of course, under the statute, that's one of the exceptions to the standard guidelines, and then as we read on further, the special circumstances, that's another exception. So, if there's a protection order, that would override the standard guidelines.
But there's not going to be confusion by saying shall in this sentence, and then having to refer to a totally different place in the law to find out that protection order trumps this. Wouldn't it be better not to have it in here? It's a good idea.
Well, I think that's probably true of a lot of the things in here. That's why we put the exception that, you know, if there's abuse of intellectual protection orders, then these don't apply.
If you detailed everything, it would be by the strike of the J.C. Penney catalog.
Exactly, because that sort of thing we can say about almost all of these provisions. I guess it's just, we're seeing a lot of non-custodial parents who want to be more involved with their children. But unfortunately, they have to go to the lawyer, get orders to get information from the school, from the doctors. They're not being notified in the event of an emergency. It's our feeling that should be the law, that they should be able to have access to that information unless there's special circumstances like protection orders or abuse or neglect or some other reason that that shouldn't occur.
Well, does this give a non-custodial parent the right to get that medical information? It just looks like he has a right to get it from the custodial parent.
Well, it indicates that the custodial parent shall provide the non-custodial parent with grade reports and notices from schools they received and shall authorize the non-custodial parent to communicate concerning the child directly with the daycare school and the children's doctor or professional. So that would be my interpretation, and the intent was that they could get the records. Unless, of course, they deal with abuse or those sorts of things. But, you know, maybe just as a this might be one of the exceptions, you know, rather than doing the catalog thing, but maybe we should indicate here that if there are issues of abuse and neglect and protection orders, that this provision doesn't apply.
Okay.
Understood that this was just clarified. We added in that clothing belonging to the child should be sent on the visits. And the reason is that otherwise it says that the custodial parent has provided clothing for special activities. Well, the non-custodial parent then says, well, we're going to want a skiing trip. You know, it says here in these guidelines that you have to provide the appropriate clothing for this. And of course, that's not true. We're going to have a lot of things. So it's really just a clarification. Next page, three, under insurance forms, we added in that the parent that has medical insurance coverage should provide an insurance card to the other parent. The child support abatement statute was changed, and so the proposal that was in your packet is inconsistent with the statute. The statute now provides that the abatement occurs when the child is with a non-custodial parent 10 or more days, and the proposal that was included in the documents indicated 10 days or more. So that was just a change that made it consistent with statute. Page 4, on the telephone communication, there's a couple changes here. One is reducing the time for contact between a parent and a child when a child is arbitration with.
On page 4?
Yes.
Where are we at?
At the very top. Oh. Just sign on page 4.
Okay.
It deals with the time period when children should contact one on vacation with the other parent. It was 5 days. We feel that may be too long, that maybe 3 days would be better. 3 days doesn't really interfere with the non-custodial parent's time. It does provide an element of security to the child and the custodial parent. Parents will know, that the child reached the location safely and that things are going well. So we're asking you to consider reducing that time from 5 to 3 days. We're also just putting in here a little suggestion that the parents may wish to provide their child with a telephone calling card to facilitate this communication, so it's not the responsibility of the non-custodial parent to pay that cost. We also added in terms of mail contact, audio and video cassettes, which a lot of parents are using, especially where they reside a ways away from their children. And we also are suggesting that parents provide their child with self-addressed stamped envelopes, for instance, in cases where the parents are more than 20 miles away, and so the child can arrive home during the summer. Doesn't cost the non-custodial parent anything. And with a lot of our parents now, most parents having that capability, we're seeing a lot of visitation communications through email. And with young children, of course, it has to be fostered and encouraged by the custodial parent, but it's a wonderful tool for parents to remain in contact with their children, and of course, older children just do it themselves. So we're asking that you consider just creating out of there, because then parents, I give this to all of my clients when I come into the office. The first thing they get is a packet which contains these guidelines, and most of them sit and read it through it and see what they should do and what they shouldn't do. Most really want to know, what can I do? And so this is, I guess, sort of a helpful tool for them to know that this is one way that they can really assist in minimizing the trauma that their children are going through in a separation or divorce. I think one of the other major changes, most of these are either grammatical or just changing the terminology, but the other main change that we're requesting is that the way the guidelines are set up for children under the age of 5, the non-custodial parent would have 3 visits during the week. What we're finding is that most of the custodial parents are working, so that if the non-custodial parent has a child under 5 3 times a week during the week, then the custodial parent only has 2 times a week. And that really makes it difficult. Well, child is not a stability, which is one of the things that we really look for in these guidelines. We want the child to be in home with the custodial parent, the majority of the time. And of course, then the dad would have visitation on the weekend or the mom board as a non-custodial parent. We also added a sentence that does say that if the custodial parent isn't working, then the non-custodial parent should have more time. But this is a really difficult area for family law lawyers with really young children, because we have really emotional time of having a child in the barn and all of that, and somebody's got breastfeeding, and then we have illnesses, and then we have cold weather, and they can't take the child out. All of these issues, and the courts were forcing these parents because they, you know, 2 hours away, they can't take the child very far, so a lot of these visits are occurring in the home where the custodial parent lives. And so, you know, sometimes the police are called away to protection orders because they're forcing these visits, and then we have children that can't communicate, so then the parents have to communicate about schedules and feedings and that sort of thing, and it's a very difficult area. So I guess that's one of the issues that I'd like you to take a look at. I'm not sure what the answer is.
What are you suggesting? That we totally eliminate?
No.
That's what I read there since it's got strike-throughs.
Apparently.
Everything on page 4 and the top of page 5.
Apparently what happened is when a computer generated the comparison, there apparently were just enough changes that it deleted yours and inserted
yours. It's on 7.
Pardon?
Yours starts on page 7.
Right.
If you have a 7, it's all there. It's all there.
It looks like what happened is that I separated children under the age of 5 as a separate number, and I think that under your proposal, that might have been just a continuation of the other numbers, and I just changed it. But
okay.
There are no changes other than deleting visitor visitation, except for this, and we're suggesting that maybe 2 visits during the week for the non-custodial parent would ease some of the conflict and some of the problems in that regard. And of course, if the parents are getting along, then we don't have that issue. And what we're seeing with these really young children are never married. And those are the most difficult kind of cases that we have to handle, is because they don't have a shared commitment or history. Typically, a child will not have a lot of goodness. So it always seems to be an especially volatile situation. I believe those are the major changes that I'm asking you to consider. I will see Justice Blankham if we get I guess now also email it to the court that might be of assistance to with these changes.
Thank
are
you.
There any questions?
Excuse me. Again, thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity to go along with you.
Okay. Next person. Your name, sir?
Brown Watch.
Did you file a document with the court indicating you wish to speak?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Good.
I apologize, Madam Attorney. I will give a key piece of my experiences and hoping that the guidelines will in the future help out the non-custodial parent and the child as well.
Before you start, could you? I think it would be helpful if I knew what I'm going to be looking at what you submitted. What is it looking
at? Well, Mr. Shane said that.
It's in the copy of 1144.
Yes, sir.
Oh, okay.
Okay. I'm not speaking, I'm not addressing this directly. I'm just here, like I said, to testify the proper and some of the problems that we've had. I hope this is something to consider. I've been a father for over 12 years. For the first 10 years of that, the children were with me every day, and my mother was working. As I heard spoken here today, that when everything is going good, the guidelines really don't matter. The guidelines are to kick in when a controversy between parents comes in, which they should. But at the point where controversy happens, and I found myself in court, and we say for the children that consistency is important. My children were with me every day when the mother was working. I picked them up after school, I didn't know where my dad was. So pretty much it was a normal life. There was no controversy. All of a sudden, when the controversy arose, we ended up on guidelines. After 10 years of immediate change and no provisions to protect me from that, and I sat in front of a judge that basically told me we weren't married. And the judge told me that it was highly unlikely that I would get the visitation I desired. Because we never
did. Well, as you can see, the guidelines here focus on the best interest of the children, not whether the people had been married at one time,
right,
are married, or never had been.
So, the problem with that is if the court does not recognize acknowledge, protect, whatever term you want to use, that to the people. The discouragement to the custodial parent, the minute we had this agreement, the custodial parent went into court, and I got slapped around by the lawyers. And then the judge found another way, or my lawyer found another way to protect me. And as far as the protection orders, I ended up with protection orders, four protection orders. I spent $2,000 for one day in court. A week later, I took $2,000 and put it in a law priority for my children. And I asked that, if I never put another dime in here, how much will this be a maturity? At 11%, it represented $574,000. Hence, I spent over $7,000. Now, I get to see my children, granted by a mother. But the court has never protected my rights. I have lots of papers, if I can read them all yet. Right here, please. They're just things, letters and articles to the letters to the editor and stuff that have shown the frustration in the attempts to spend time with my children. And it needs to be recognized somehow. And I'm asking how you guys can get into the guidelines.
You have to pay support.
Yes, sir.
Okay. And so you're saying you go to court and you get no visitation through court?
No, they were willing to offer me the guidelines every other weekend after my children get through with me every day. I was allowed every other weekend and possibly one day a week. Which she started arguing that I was some kind of a nut and that the kids needed counseling and I needed counseling and stuff like that. It becomes a very easy area, and I'm not even a plain lawyer or argue law, but I think you can understand at the point, and some of my letters and things will express it, at the point where we get into court and we start talking to attorneys, and the attorneys, whatever, somehow, my rights as a father are being violated, I feel. Because I've been there for 12 years. And for the children and for I should continue to be there. And granted, the guidelines come to a point of where if I don't say that they are unfair by any means, but we seem to use best interests of the child repeatedly. And best interest of the child is equal access to both parents as much as possible. And we can't cloud that issue. I did send a letter in to give you more frustration. I sent a letter in Chief Justice Gilbertson, that you sent for you. And I appreciate your response back. This was addressing the issue of when the judge had come up with me in court. He sent me back a nice letter that told me where to send the letter. I sent the letter to that office and never received a response back. I also sent one to Judge Meyer, and I knew some attorneys had told me was the head of our in Sioux Falls. She was some kind of lead judge or something.
She's a presiding judge.
Pardon me, sir?
She's a presiding judge in Minnehaha.
Thank you. I sent a letter to her with the same concerns as I sent to you. She took it upon her power to forward it back to my attorney, who I'd already let go, and then she had the graciousness to send a copy of it to the judge in question, which I don't understand, because I may have to be in front of him again. So, I guess I'm here to ask that somehow when we're looking at the guidelines, do we understand innocent until proven guilty, both the parents and the child's life, and somehow discourage any abuse or ability to abuse these guidelines?
Let me ask you this.
Yes, sir.
There's nothing we can pass to get two people to get along.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, there sometimes has to be a judge tries to accommodate both parties. And, you know, I always have to remember this story. I can remember walking out of court when the opponent wasn't too happy with me.
Sounds like
my client was probably even madder at me, because there's no guarantees in life. So you understand the court is trying to look after the best interest of the child, and there's no guarantee that everyone gets absolutely what they think they should have.
Absolutely not. The best interest of the child is such an ambiguous term. It's a term that's used, really, best interest of the child flat out is fair access to both parents. As the child gets older, they're going to wonder why they're not having the access to their father. I say father because, to my understanding, 98% of us out here are custodial of our fathers. And that, to me, in itself,
in any other arena would be a discrimination. At the very less, it would be pigeonholing fathers over to this category, or a gender profiling that we're the ones that we see able to take care of the parent. I guess, we're here to talk about guidelines, and I don't want to stray too far from it, but it's been a nightmare. Financially, physically, emotionally, or every aspect.
So would you like, I wrote down what you said. If I understand you correctly, you'd like something in the guidelines that says that the history of the contact between the children and the parents should be a consideration in setting a fair...
It should always be a strong consideration. Thank you for wording it for me. But yeah, that is what I'm saying. But also just a pure consideration when the guidelines come forward. And I'm speaking from feelings. You may, as judges yourself, interpret this differently. But as the guidelines look to me, when I go in, the least, my attorney said to me, at least we're going to get the guidelines. Well, immediately... I'm placed to, 6 days a month? Now, how can we as a society, looking at statistics that I read daily about the importance of, if not both parents, the father of the child's life, say that 6 days of involvement of the father in his child's life is going to have any effect? And I applaud this young lady back here who wanted to change the term visitation to parenting. We've talked about that for 2 years. We are parents. And when the bitterness between a custodial and non-custodial parent grows, and one parent knows that they have control, and whether one tell the truth or tell the not, one parent has control. The other parent gets run over. And the assets of the children go to the lawyer. I told my lawyer right up front, I said, your child's going to go to college. Mine isn't. But I said, that's probably okay, because someday your child can represent my child. There's no need for my son's future to go to the attorney. $160 an hour. I paid for my last day of court.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Any questions? Comments? Yelling?
No, yelling.
At the back?
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. Any further comments? Your name, sir?
Tim Stratton.
Did you file anything with the court indicating that you were going to speak?
Yep.
You did?
Yep.
Very well.
44.
Okay.
I've been divorced for 7 years. I guess I'm right or wrong. What's the use of having guidelines if the courts aren't even going to enforce the guidelines? I've been in and out of court for 7 years. I've played the game, put the visitation guidelines, and now I just walk away from it. I'm tired of paying attorneys. I paid $30,000 to try to get custody of my children. The judge came out and stated, when he first went in front of the judge, she said, here, you're sitting here. He looks at you, I don't know you, I don't know you, I'm here for the children. Fine. She gets custody, you get visitation rights. I told my attorney afterwards, I wish I would have known what was going to happen to me when I walked in the courtroom, because I would have filed gender bias right there. Because he doesn't know either one of us, but yet we're sitting in the courtroom, and she gets the rights on the children, and I get visitation rights. It's been every night. I put my kids to bed, I got up with them, changed their diapers, I fed them, I put them back to bed. I did everything for my children. My children felt that they were put in the middle. And that's what's happening right now today. Children are in the middle. They don't want to be in the middle. Coming up with a shared parenting plan and being able to make parents get along. That's what I'm here for. There are several states that have taken this on already. West Virginia, it was about a year and a half ago. They came out with a plan. The judge came out and said, you will go to a class that deals with some kind of anger, custody type deal where you are going to come up with a parenting plan. It was working in West Virginia. There's several plans in Sioux Falls and in South Dakota that are out there now. This one right here is from Marriage Savers. It's a 6-week course. It deals with one, it deals with marriages, it deals with marriages that are on the rocks, plus it deals with people to be able to get along. Conflict resolution is what it deals with. I've been through the course once already. I'm sitting with some of the legislative people through this course right now. That's my plan. I'm going to try to sell this down. Sioux Falls, after you have went through the court, you beat each other to death, you have brought every mud, you brought everything in the court, then you're going to send into the SMILE program. How many people can smile if you spend $30,000 in court? Plus you got ran down by the judge so bad, you don't want to walk into a courtroom again. I don't want to walk into a courtroom again. Last time I was in the courtroom, I proved that my ex-wife was not only cohabitating with my children, having sex in front of my children, drinking in front of my children, and whatnot.
You know, just a minute. I'd like to take, I don't want to hold you back, but this isn't the time and place for going into what you're going into. This is not the right forum. This relates to a rules hearing.
Correct.
And your letter addressed something that you haven't even talked about. And just because you've signed your name to a letter that you would like to speak here doesn't mean you get the opportunity to harangue circuit court judges where we don't know the facts about or anything else. You can speak to something that has relevance to the rules, and would you confine your comments to that?
Okay.
Relevance to the guidelines, really.
Okay. This is an article from September 15, 1993. Circuit Judge Lee Anderson had made, if one parent refused to allow another to see the children, too many kids are growing up, one parent, usually the father, he said. Our system isn't set up to encourage fathers to be involved in the lives of their children after divorce, he said. Now this is from a judge. This is from 1993, almost 10 years ago. Now we're still with the same. We're still with the same. Coming out of 1144, being able to put a shared parenting plan together. Being able to have two parents, instead of being able to come to a courtroom, fight for 6 months and spend $40,000 to $50,000, you can come up with a shared parenting plan to where people can sit down, not have to spend their life savings or go into bankruptcy to be able to get along for the children. That's what we're here for. We're here for the best interest of the children. I don't know what the best interest is. I've asked 10 people, 10 people will give me a different, that's totally different.
So what should we do? I mean, the guidelines that we drew up 12 years ago was an effort to try to get people who were fighting over children. We're talking to five people who have dealt with this for all their careers. We understand the problem. But what's the solution?
Well, I'll tell you, 12 years ago compared to today, and that's what I was trying to get into when the judge told me it's the 90s, live with it. We're in the year 2000. It's time that we start going with other states. It's time to realize what is in the best interest of the children. I don't believe the best interest is with both parents. And you can make that happen. But you have to come out with a program. We have programs for everything. You know, if I don't pay my child support on the deadbeat, people are going to come after me. But you know, when I lose my visitation, I don't get visitation, I don't find out when my kids go to the doctors, I don't find out what grades they get, there's nothing done. This doesn't have to happen. I've been through it. My kids are right here. I got one daughter now living with me. She's 13 years old. She's been with me for going on 4 months now. I still pay my full child support, but I want to be with my kids. I've been doing this for 4 years now. I've been with Mr. Coyson from day one. I've been up here for child support committees. I've been up here for visitation committees. There's been times when I came up here and I've wasted my time because when you're going to talk on a bill, forget it, we're not taking any input on the bills. We don't want to hear from you. Well, this is where my son is going to be. I've watched kids go through this time and time again.
I view those kids in my neighborhood that are going through it day in and day out. I watch kids get beat by their moms, and they tell you to shut up and don't turn again because I don't want my mom to get in trouble. I watch kids.
But that isn't something that this proposal deals with. Well, I understand your frustration, but you know, I've sat there and I've told people, listen, I don't want to hear that anymore. You got to start acting like grown adults.
Correct.
Because anything you do reflects poorly on the kids, and the kids, they aren't going to know who to believe, what to believe. And you know, I sat there, and then 2 weeks later, they sat in front of me and shook their heads like this, and they're back in the same position. And you know, it's disheartening to me because, you know, we read a lot of things about kids that just tear your heart up, and the way they're treated, and through abuse and everything. But you know something? The law sometimes can't force people to change, and that's the hardest thing to see, is that they don't, sometimes they've got blinders on and can't see the bad impact that it has on kids in the formative years. And I think all this is an attempt to see, tell people you've got to get along, and hope and pray they do. But there's nothing we can change about people you've seen, you know what I mean?
If we can come up with a program on shared parenting, being able to get people in, and to be able to deal with their conflicts instead of going to court and fighting their conflicts, dealing with them before you go to court, would that be done in the best interest of the child?
Well, this is a first step towards what you're trying to say we should do, and that is giving the non-custodial parents certain visitation rights when they get served with the divorce papers so they don't have to go into court to get some kind of visitation. This would be implemented in numerous cases. So it is a step in the direction. I don't know if it goes as far as what you want.
I'm reading Section 3. It says, any minor child of the marriage shall remain in the custody of the parent who has been the primary caregiver for the minor children for the majority of time in the 30 days preceding the filings of summons and complaint.
Right. What this attempts to do is to give visitation to the non-custodial parent without that non-custodial parent having to go to court to get it as soon as the court action is filed.
Okay, now are you trying to say that, I've got a month's vacation, I'm going to take that month's vacation, spend as much time with my children, and then I'm going to file for a divorce?
I guess I will follow.
I've had more custody with my children out of the last 30 days with my children. Should I file for a divorce after that then?
We are here to give you advice on how to take advantage of the other side. So let's just confine your comments to what's an improvement or a liability about the guidelines.
Well, I guess to me, I mean, this should be taken out. It should be just full street shared parenting.
You know, the problem
parents
is,
should be able to be with both parents.
The problem is, this was passed by the legislature.
Correct.
Well, we can't repeal that.
So that means I got to bring a bill up again next year.
Right.
Okay.
We don't have any authority to override legislative actions as long as they're in the Constitution. And all this stuff is implemented with the legislature has set guidelines, set the general parameters and bill.
And then they directed that we have to end up providing rules.
Well, I guess these rules right here, they're not the way to go. It's not going to cure the problem of what's out there.
Okay, fine.
The children are going to suffer.
You might want to take that up to the legislature then, because all this stuff is implement what they told us to do.
Okay.
Any further comments? Yes, sir. Do you make?
Yes, Kelly.
Okay.
Submitted.
Yes, I know you did. Okay.
Listening to the last three speakers, I don't know
and the courts can do what they want to. And, you know, in a statement that we can't force, the law can't force people to act, that's absolutely true. Two people don't want to get along, they want. The problem I see with the present guidelines is they inherently give one person an advantage in the bargaining situation to start with. And so the parent is likely to be deemed the custodial parent, which many times is the mother, does not really have an incentive to bargain to replace the father. Because she's aware before she goes to court that that's likely to be the way that the court would rule. And so she may call from the father and argue about an hour or two one way or the other, but a lot of times we end up in two situations we just heard about where the fathers are, you know, extremely frustrated and feel like they don't have much input. And so I guess, you know, I don't want to go line by line because I first started off with an adjustment trying to do some edits and not one whatever. I probably kill more trees doing that than just starting over. But the one thing I did, like one speaker said, that I did not use the word visitation, the same logic that she suggested. The other thing is that I tried to structure the concept as evenly as possible. I guess my hope would be is that, you know, if the guidelines that I suggested were effective, that they would never have to be implemented by the court. That the parties would always be able to agree before they got to court. It's probably not possible, but I think that would be the best for all parties concerned if they can come to the bargaining table in equal positions and the parties themselves can work it out without you having to be involved in trying to decide what's best for someone. And so I guess my request is that you would just, you know, look through what I suggested. It's not perfect. I didn't cover every last issue. And there's a lot of situations that I did not cover. But I guess I made the assumption that many times both parents are competent and equally qualified, and the child should have equal access to the parents.
Your motivation is excellent. And, you know, and if we can get people to co-parent with these guidelines and can change the language a little bit to promote that, you know, that is really good. But as to some of your specific things, I would like to ask you about under 1.16, at least on one form I've got, it says it relates to child abuse. And it says, when child abuse has been established and a continuing danger is shown to exist, all visitation time with the abusive parent should cease or only be allowed under supervision depending on the circumstances. Court intervention is usually required in child abuse cases. Now, you've replaced all of that, and you have just simply said, when child abuse has been established, the court's decision will prevail. In a set of guidelines, I mean, do you think that your substantive language is better than what was there?
Well, I'm not trying to leave the question. Your judgment on that is definitely going to be better than in that situation.
I don't know if it would be better. I suppose it'll be more final, do you think it was necessary? Did you feel it was necessary to get rid of the sentence, or were you just trying to shorten it up?
Well, it was my important goal to shorten it. Part of it, child abuse is not appropriate, whether it's custodial or not custodial. And so that was my part of my objective is to prevent having these two classes of parents as much as possible.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Kelly?
No. I think my wife would like to make a comment.
Okay. Mrs. Kelly?
Yes.
Did she also sign the letter, so she was going to move?
Yes.
With reverence and humility, I approach this court. I am not sure. claim to present a legal argument. What I do possess is awareness through my own personal and professional experiences. I merely request the opportunity to share some of my discoveries. As my husband and I mentioned in our cover letter to the court, we have both personal and professional experience in separation maintenance orders dealing with custody of children. At the close of my initial custody proceeding 20 years ago, my attorney gave me the best advice possible. He shared that my estranged husband and I could have the court resolve all and any disputes, or we could figure out how to resolve them ourselves. He warned, every time we would come into the courtroom, we would feel a wedge being driven deep into the relationship. He observed that I was feeling the first wedge being driven. As my husband and I do not make a claim as to having the most successful divorces, but we do have amicable working relationships with our former spouses. I have my own personal ideas as to the common threads in successful divorces. We have applied some of these universal ideas in order to maintain a pleasant working relationship with our former spouses. The child needs to have a relationship with all of their parents. And one of the ways that I can illustrate this to people that come from a traditional setting is that I was raised with access to both sets of grandparents, and both sets of grandparents were equally important. And our children being raised in a blended family have two sets of parents. They view my husband, their stepdad, just as much their father as their biological father. And same with my husband's children from his first marriage, I am their mother. All parents are of equal importance to the development of the child. We have a responsibility in developing, helping our children to develop, to provide them with access to all of their family members. My former spouse has children from his present marriage, and I provide opportunity for those children to engage with the children from our marriage. It's all a result of responsibility, not just the maternal, the mother with the maternal parents. An acceptance that when children are involved, the two parties are bound together beyond the child's age of majority. The children are innocent of choosing the situation, and their needs come first. I would like to address a situation that deals with breastfeeding. My personal experience started with my first two children born prematurely. Due to their precarious health situation, I established and maintained a breast milk supply with a breast pump. With an electric breast pump. My second child was 6 weeks old when I underwent an appendectomy. Consequently, both children were fed breast milk with a bottle, held closely to be affirmed, and were 1 to 2 months old before either went to breast. I went on to breastfeed both children until they were approximately 2 years of age. The youngest child was 15 months old when my estranged husband and I separated. My former spouse cared for the youngsters on overnight stays. The choice of breastfeeding was not a variable to exalt me as more important than my former spouse. Professionally, I have supported working moms and dads in breastfeeding and bottle feeding concurrently with absolute contentment on the infant's part. I have supported mothers who choose not to breastfeed by assuring them that they will bond with their infant without breastfeeding. I know this because I bond with the children who are entrusted into my care. I have a commitment to the child to promote their best interest, and this is the root of bonding, not breastfeeding. The standard guidelines state defined time blocks. These blocks of time are most disruptive to the natural cycles of an infant. The limits on time are extremely short, leaving the child distressed. The child and adult are not provided the necessary time needed to engage in order to develop a trust relationship. The overnight blocks do not lend themselves to meaningful parent-child relationship building. The 12-hour limit does not provide for any transitional time for the child at start or close, much less relationship development. In 1991, I chose to be a family child care provider. My mother had provided virtually all of the care for my children when I worked outside of the home. Even though I had little exposure to the industry, I had definite expectations of the care provided to my children. I have used this model as my foundation in my 5-1 child care business. As a working parent support system, my role is one that brings me into the inner circle of the dynamics of a child's family. I see our parents in need of a continuous mentoring system to teach parenting skills. I see our children being raised by children. I see a need for accountability as to parenting decisions. I see children going into situations that most assuredly will preclude them from attaining their potential. A child is born into any one of a variety of situations. This situation will be a determinant as to the probability of the child being able to attain their potential. The most desirable situation would be one that is framed by a mature and stable couple who together are committed to their family. This couple would have a working knowledge of problem solving, negotiation, effective communication skills, parenting skills, and an ability to promote others over self. A child needs to be exposed to these skills as well as an accounting of the rules that govern them. I fear that these essential skills are stifled under the present standard guidelines. However, the Internal Revenue Code does provide for such a framework that requires parental cooperation, effective communication skills, accountability, and focusing on the needs of the child. The framework is due to determining the dependent exemption, Title 26, United States Code. Internal Revenue Title, Section 151 and 152 detail this exemption. Publication 17 and 501 provide the instructions and the worksheet to determine entitlement to the dependent exemption. Every day, I aid youngsters in determining problem-solving skills, negotiation, effective communication, and an awareness of the situation at hand. I do this by first establishing a trust relationship through a commitment to the infant or child. I then equip them with the tools to be most effective in their society. I provide a secure and consistent framework that includes, above all, affirmation, then age-appropriate boundaries and guidelines, age-appropriate accountability, and age-appropriate consequences. I have seen two-year-olds demonstrating their ability to negotiate and compromise. The guidelines can expect at least as much from parents. I plead with this court to make radical changes in the standard guidelines for the sake of our children.
Okay. Thank you.
Any questions for me?
No, I just had it. I know that your goal is laudable, but can guidelines assure that?
I think the framework of the guidelines will not guarantee that people will act right. You can't pass enough laws to get people to act right. But what can happen is there can be a framework in which there is a reason for them to desire to work together.
You can order mediation, but there's no guarantee that there will be a successful resolution, is there?
That's why I brought up the Internal Revenue Code, because as I understand it, unless the parents have been married, the multiple support agreement must be determined, and that the divorce decree not being present cannot be applied. For example, on form
and that has to do with who gets the deduction, doesn't it?
Exactly. And so what has to happen is, since Form 8332 is the release of claim to exemption for child of divorce or separated parents, since that cannot be, since under the caution, this support test does not apply to parents who never married each other. And what the code is saying, as I understand it, and what I understand from the Research Department and the Internal Revenue Service, is that this worksheet in publication 501 must be filled out, and it requires parents and anybody who has provided support towards the child to work in cooperation with each other. first marriage are going to cost more to raise just because they have two homes, because they have to be transported between two homes. And the cost to get my children to their father is also incurred by me, because I have a responsibility for my children. And that's not just an expense that's incurred by the non-residential and non-custodial parent. And this worksheet lays all that out. The Internal Revenue Code has it all laid out exactly what expenses can be applied towards what the total support to raise this child is for the year. And it lends itself an accountability. When my former spouse was paying child support, I can't help but wonder, I can't help but assume that he must have thought that I was not using all of the money correctly. And I know I use the same, you know, that, well, he just doesn't know how much it costs to raise a child. And this worksheet would lay it out in front of both parties to see and provide for cooperation and accountability, and to see the big picture as a whole, not just their own picture.
Thank you. Any further comments? If not, the court will take these comments under advisement, study the proposed rules,